Welcome back, Raw Thoughts listeners, to another episode with me, Mackenzie Tiggs. I want to remind you that you are able to go on to rawthoughtspodcast.com and look at all of the previous guests that have been able to come on and be vulnerable and share their stories with me. I love when other guests have been able to connect with each other, or even people within the community have been able to reach out to them and say, hey, I connect with you. I would love to, you know, kind of further this relationship, and they build their own relationship. I also want to remind you that I sell real estate in the Treasure Valley in Idaho. So if you are looking to buy or sell or invest in the area, I would absolutely love for you to reach out to me. You can send me an email on my Raw Thoughts podcast or onto my Instagram. You know how to find me. All of my show notes have my contact information as well. So today I have a guest coming on willing to really share the vulnerability of parenting and counseling and kind of what we have to endure with our lives and figuring things out. And it sounds like she thought she had figured things out and then had her own child and kind of had to dive into another layer of what that looked like. So today I have Sangam. And did I pronounce that right? No.
No,
you pronounce it for me.
Okay. It's Sangam.
Sangam. Okay.
Yeah, perfect.
And tell us about yourself.
I don't know where to start, and I don't know that I completely know myself yet.
Yeah.
I'm in the midst of, like, you know, paying attention to what my body feels like in different situations and looking at my I don't know, just where I'm spending my energy.
Yeah. So tell us just kind of your work history. Let's start there.
Work history. I think it started when I was about 9. And my American sister and a good friend of ours, we started a organization called Mother Earth's Little Helpers. And we raised money by selling things at crafts fairs, and we adopted a chimpanzee.
Whoa.
That was being abused. And we bought a small portion of the rainforest to protect it. And then I remember having a conversation with my dad. We were on our way to Yosemite, and I remember telling him how sad it was that in India there were so many people that needed help and you could just really see it on the streets. And I wanted to open up a hospital that would give them what they needed without, like, being in the economic system that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that was like a kind of a combination of a dream that my mother had for me, which was to become a doctor, but then, like, my own kind of drive for, I don't know, like, finding that place where, because I know that we live in abundance, like, there's enough to go around and more left over, and I don't quite understand the world because I live in that world. Mm-hmm. Like that internal world. And so, yeah, so then I've kind of, like, been finagling my, like, professional history, like, my professional existence to appease maybe, like, my dad and kind of what I wanted, and, like, maybe my American father comes into it, and my mom comes into it, and, like, the expectations that society has, and being from India, you know, you're supposed to be a doctor, basically.
Yeah.
And then as a woman, you become a doctor, and then you get arranged marriage, and then you just stay at home, and, yeah, and you're like a home take, you know, home, what is it called?
Like a stay-at-home mom and like a homemaker.
Homemaker.
A homemaker.
That's it.
That's how you know I'm not a homemaker.
I am. And so I, like, came up with this whole thing where I was like, okay, the hospital that I want to make is for people that are getting sick. And maybe if I addressed the root cause of the problem, maybe if I address, like, the hygiene and water side of things, that I could even prevent people needing to, like go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's kind of the situation in the US where you don't go to the hospital for water related diseases. But in India, people die right and left. And so, let's see. And so then I was like, okay, I think I'll become an engineer. And I always knew that I was interested in like physics. Geology was somehow very interesting to me. I think that was because the teacher was really great. Those were my favorite subjects, when the teachers really understood the beginner's mindset and knew how to teach from that. And so I go into engineering and kind of feeling like I'm going to save the world. And yeah, what happens? My mom wants me to be a doctor, so I get a PhD. So I'm like, hey, I'm a doctor. I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, almost appeasing, like you said, your parents.
And oh, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, you've spoken on your Indian father and then your American father. What is that? What is your family dynamics?
So I grew up in a village that I'm kind of proud of this fact. I love sharing it. That still doesn't have electricity in India.
Wow.
I was in India for 4 years, not in the same location, but just, you know, within India, living with one grandparent or the other. I think my mom was working on her master's when she was pregnant with me. And when my dad is like a businessman at heart, and so he moved us to Nepal, and he opened up like this, you know, very small bookstore. And it was in the 80s, and it was like when things were really booming in terms of like tourism.
Okay.
And so he moved us there. He started like his book business from a shoebox, basically. And then I was in Nepal for 4 years. I was in boarding school for two of those. And while we were there, my parents made really good friends with foreigners. And one woman wanted to bring me to the U.S. And she met us like at the very beginning of our move there. So like since I was four, she knew me. And so finally when I was, she would ask, I think she asked multiple times to bring me here. And my parents were like, we're not too sure about this. And then finally they just agreed. And so I came to the U.S. with an American woman.
Okay. And so your parents were just like, how did they have that conversation with you? They're like, we're going to have you go to America.
I think I was a really like adventurous child. There wasn't much that scared me. And so to me, it was an exciting thing. I was really like excited to get on a plane for the first time. And yeah.
Did you know at that age that like America had more opportunities than what India had? Or did you question like, why am I going to go to the US and leave my family behind?
Yeah. So I think my father's vision was that I would go to the US, learn English really well, come back and run the business.
Okay.
And then my mother's vision was I would get a really good education and come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone back?
Yeah. So the American woman that brought me here, she decided that she really didn't have the energy. She was like a grandmother age to me. She didn't have the energy to take care of me. So I was actually going to go back to Nepal. But then her oldest daughter, somehow they agreed to become my guardians. And so her oldest daughter was married, had a daughter the same age as me.
Okay. And that's who you call your American sister.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any other siblings that you have?
Yeah, I have three blood sisters, I guess. I don't know. I just for clarification, yeah. It's kind of a weird term. Biological sisters, I guess. And then I have one half brother.
Okay. Yeah. And do you, like, what's that relationship? Are they still in India? Did they ever come to the U.S.?
Yeah, good question. My life is so complicated. The sister that's after, I'm the oldest. So the next oldest sister, her name is Chuku. We have two names in India. There's like a pet name and then a, what's it called? Official name. So like your passport and things. And at school, they call you by your official name. And then at home, you're called something else.
Okay.
So my sister, Chuku, that's the home name. Pragya is her like official name. And so she joined me here when she was 13 and I was 15.
And any other siblings join you or no?
No. My sister Muku, who's after Chuku, was supposed to be the one to join me and things. Well, she was supposed to join me at some point. I don't remember the chronological order of things. And just something very odd happened that she didn't get to join me. Yeah.
Okay. And so you grow up here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You still have this.
Oh, did I go back? That was your question.
Yeah.
I was leading up to that. Okay. So I did end up staying in the U.S. Every other year I would go back for the summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you still have a great relationship with your parents? Or not really?
Well, I think it's hard to define great. I don't know if I made the right decision, but when I was 28, I decided to disconnect from my family. And so I have a good relationship with my parents in my heart, but maybe not like a physical, I don't know, not like the traditional sense.
Yeah. And what made you make that disconnection?
I have a lot of trauma from my past. I was sexually abused by my dad, and like there was no ownership of that being wrong. And so I couldn't exactly, you know, stay around that energy.
Yeah.
Because it was still happening even when I was 28 to other people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is these the things that you are trying to process still now, trying to work through, trying to?
I don't think so. I think when I was 33, I processed through that part of it. And the really big work that I did then was like, I did 1 year of EMDR with an amazing therapist. And what I processed then, which, you know, logically, this is hard for people to understand. What I processed then was when I went into therapy, I thought it was mostly my fault that it had happened, that I could have been stronger somehow. And so like, I think my therapist asked me very wisely, she's like, so what percentage do you think is your fault? And what percentage do you think it's your dad's responsibility? And I don't remember the numbers exactly, but if I was to recall the energy of the numbers, it would be like, I thought it was like maybe 80% my fault and 20% his. And when I was done with therapy, it was 100% his.
Yeah.
So I feel like that healing happened then. And I've always been like a really forgiving person. Like I don't really get angry or mad. I just know in my heart that my dad must have had it harder than I even had it to be able to do something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did your mom know that that was happening? Did people around you know that was happening and was still accepted?
I'm kind of confused by that because I don't think people talk about it. Like, it's kind of a taboo. I kind of get the idea that, like, perhaps because, you know, it's like arranged marriages. And so, like, the women or the girls, they don't experience relationships until they are, like, married.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go into the marriage like not even knowing what sex is, because, or like even like even what that physical bond looks like. And so I'm not sure, but I think in the Indian culture, it's accepted that the father demonstrates what that looks like.
Yeah.
And so it happened with my mom, and I think my grandpa was just doing it out of like, it's my duty, but he did not feel good about it. And like, that was like, that was kind of the, this is my duty and that's it and I'm done.
Okay.
And so I, you know, I really don't know, but I kind of get the sense that maybe my mom knew, but she didn't know that it was like turning into the abuse that it was, you know, like the age that it started, or, you know, like maybe you would demonstrate it if, you know, things are different everywhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And whatever you're raised with feels normal. And so like to Indians, maybe it felt normal that like once a child was at a certain age and they were ready for marriage, that like the father would demonstrate something.
Mm-hmm.
And with my father, though, like it was not that. It was like starting at a very young age, abusing like anyone and anything that came in his path. You know, he must have some sort of thing with like the, you know, sexual trauma in his own past to have done that and to repeat it and all of that. And so, okay, you want to bring me back to what we were talking about?
You're good. You are talking what your heart is feeling, and that is vulnerability right there for you to even be sharing this with us. So I'm getting teared up because that is such an amazing like strength of you to say, hey, this has happened to me. And not only was that good, but I've also had to work through that. And I've also recognized like it wasn't my fault, you know, and there's many, many, many people out there that's the easiest thing that we can, you know, put a label on is they probably did it because I did something wrong. And in reality, most of the times, it's actually something that they have not dealt with or something of their past. And then they're reflecting on that as well. And I do want to note, you know, that I've been blessed over the last couple years to really get very close with a couple Indian families. And I will note that they're a different way of living, you know. And so I love the way that you say, like, whatever you're raised in, that's your normal. And it may not make sense to people that are listening to this, and it may not make sense of what has happened, but to you, that is what has happened, you know? And it's now dissecting and figuring out, how do I actually feel about this? And how do I continue with this of being your story? So I just want to give you, I just want to give you like props of you're doing an amazing thing right now. And I am so privileged that you are even opening up so much, you know, on my podcast and in this. So one of the things just listening to this, and I can understand why now, right, that you have kind of distanced yourself from your parents. Sometimes with our parents, that we, just because they birth us doesn't mean that we need to give energy into them, and doesn't mean that we need to have them in our lives the way that most other people have the parental, you know, guidance in that. How has that, I mean, did you have an arranged marriage when you were, you know, older? Like how did that sculpt into the relationships with men that you have now?
So interestingly enough, all of my sisters had love marriages. And I think in my whole entire family history, we were the only ones. I am divorced from my first husband. My sister Muku is divorced from her husband. And then Chuku and my youngest sister, Gunja, they're still married to the people that they married originally.
Yeah.
So when I was young, I actually like it seemed like a fairy tale thing, you know, to get an arranged marriage. Like, it was very, you know, something that I would daydream about. And when I graduated from undergrad, I went home to India. I was running an NGO that was getting young people together to clean up because garbage is just everywhere. And I was trying to beautify some areas where there were homeless people living. And I ran into all kinds of issues, just in terms of getting permission from the government. One time we cleaned up a bunch, like this pond, and we had a pile up of a bunch of plastic garbage. And I called the people that would pick up the garbage, and I thought like somebody would come there and like take the garbage away. And somebody came and just like lit it on fire, and that was it. And I was like, ooh. Yeah. And so while I was there, well, before I left, I broke up with my boyfriend at the time. And then he showed up at my doorstep in India, asking me to marry him. And that very much, like in a really weird way, felt like an arranged marriage, because I was submerged in my culture and I didn't think that I could say no to some guy showing up and saying, hey, I want to marry this person. And so I married him. I think he really did love me. And I don't know. I just felt pressured into the whole thing. But the most beautiful thing that comes out of it is that I had a really amazing Indian wedding. I felt very special. I felt so beautiful. He came in on a horse. I mean, it was a fairy tale wedding. Yeah.
And something that you had dreamt of ever since you were a little girl.
Yep. And it was 5 days long. It went into the night, 4 o'clock in the morning. You hear the birds chirping while the ceremonies are going on still. It was really cool.
Tell us a little bit about like a ceremony for 5 days, you know, and I know that they go into different aspects of, you know, the air and like how you're going to, like it's so sacred. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about like what actually goes into those 5 days of an Indian wedding?
Yeah. So it starts with like the preparation of the bride. And so a lot of the women, they come and they bless the bride, and they do this like ceremony where they have like turmeric mixed in with like flour, and all the women take a turn and they kind of like clean the girl off a little bit. I actually wrote like a little tiny book on this. Because I was like, why are we doing all this? I want to know the reasons. I always want to know like the foundation of why things are happening.
Yeah.
And yeah. So there's probably like 1 or 2 days of preparation of the girl in terms of blessing and just kind of enjoying those last moments with her, actually, because once she's married, she goes and lives with her husband's family. So it's a big goodbye. There's a lot of like ceremonial things that happen before it's like a wedding party that's happening, and then there's a bunch of ceremonial stuff that happens after the wedding party happens.
Okay.
And so there's like I think it's called a pandit, which is basically like a clergy person that comes and they like carry out the whole entire ordeal. And then like on the husband's side, there's a whole other thing going on. And so because my husband was from America and like did not have his family there, and like his family would not have known what to do for the Indian stuff anyways, my family was carrying on both things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they like staged like the whole thing, like after the girl goes off with the husband to live with the family, like they took me to my aunt's house, and that was like our, you know, me going to my husband's. And then there's a whole like 1 or 2 day thing there that happens in accepting the bride. And the bride is like really doted upon. And I remember when we would accept women into our family, and I just, oh, it was such a beautiful thing. I just, they were like such angels to me, just so beautiful every time they came in to our family.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And how did that, I mean, how long were you married with him?
Maybe 2 years. So I got married. I really wanted to stay in India and continue what I was doing, but he wanted to be in the U.S. He was in the military, which is like yuck to me. Mm-hmm. And then he wanted to move back here, so I did. And like, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I was like, maybe I'll just get a PhD. And he was like away for most of our marriage in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so I went to school in Davis. I was like, okay, I'll get a PhD in engineering, make my mom happy. Just, she can put a doctor in front of my name and, you know, did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
When was it that you started realizing like, I'm going to not do this for other people and I'm going to start doing what Sangam wants to do?
Still realizing it. Yeah. Because I not only do things, I not only do things for other people, but I also do things for the earth. And I'm really trying to like find that balance of like what's calling to me and not what is right for everybody and the earth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where are you with that right now? What's really calling you?
I had a realization the other day that, like, I'm a healer. And when I sense, I actually just had this realization this morning, this other part. It's really hard for me because I can sense other people's energy in terms of their emotions. And it either like creates space in my chest or it creates constriction. And I do this thing called holding the space. And I learned that when I became a yoga, certified yoga instructor. And what I realized was when I feel that constriction, instead of like cringing from it because it is painful in my body, I can hold the space for whoever is involved in that energy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I'm a healer. I'm like toying with all different kinds of things right now. I am thinking about becoming a minister, which like that was like a 2-month-old idea. That is a 2-month-old idea. I go to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship here in Boise. I think it's technically in Garden City. And I've been going there for less than a year, and I'm probably more involved than people that have been going there forever. Maybe. I don't know. I just really taken a deep dive in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's something that's pulling your energy into it, right? Like you're freely giving yourself to that space and not feeling constricted and not feeling, you know, that those hurdles in front of you.
I'm still navigating that. Like I'm trying to pay attention to what constricts and what expands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you also have a kiddo.
Yeah.
How old is your kiddo?
She's 5.
Oh. Tell us a little bit about navigating between your culture, the way you were raised, and now you're raising a child.
I don't think I'm raising her within the Indian culture context. I also don't know that I'm raising her within the American culture context. It's something in between. And something that I really love about my name is that it means confluence. And I don't know how my dad gave me that name, but I couldn't represent it more than, you know, its definition. And in India, there is a holy place where three rivers, holy rivers, come together, and it's called the Sangam. And so in terms of raising my child, I would say it's something in between. And so in India, there is this sense of collectivist society. And I feel like there's like a more of a living in abundance because you have so much support from people. People really caring for each other, like a communal energy. Mm-hmm. And then in the US, it's very like individualistic, and that's a tough one for me to like feel in my body because it just like doesn't feel right. But then the collectivist also doesn't feel quite right because then there's like a lot of things that are happening, like in the what is it called when like group speak, what is it, groupthink? Yeah, groupthink. And so a lot of things can be happening that are not healthy, but they're just kind of like, I need to look good for society.
Yeah. And I think what you have said too is the context, right? Like following what everybody else is doing, you know, with the Indian culture or the US culture, mm-hmm. and you're doing what you want to do and how you want to raise your child.
Yeah. And so for me, it's really important that she is like raised in community. And so I have very deep connections with a lot of people here, and I'm developing them actively. And so she has a lot of play dates. When I need help, I reach out to the parents and ask them to watch her. It's very rare that parents will reach out to me for help, but I will because of that communal nature. Mm-hmm. Although I've made it very clear that I'm like, my door is always open. Like, this is a place that no matter what's happening, we are going to adjust to the needs of everybody. And something that I like to teach children, I spend a lot of time with kids, even though like I'm not a teacher or anything like that. I like to teach people about like win-win-win solutions, because oftentimes we think there has to be compromise in coming up with a solution. And so I work with all the kiddos that I'm ever with. I'm like, okay, what's our win-win-win solution? And it's not always successful. Like if it's rushed, it's not going to be super successful. I end up being the one that kind of gives in, like, okay, yeah, we'll stop for a treat. Let's just get going. Mm-hmm. But you'd be surprised. You know, two kiddos are having trouble and I say, what's a win-win solution? They have a conversation and it's like, they figure it out, and it's so beautiful. And so I don't know where I was going with that. What, can you remind me what we were?
You were talking about kind of the in-between.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm definitely in the in-between, and it's not always easy because there have been times when I have been like in very, very deep need of help, and like a person might not be willing to not go to a birthday party to help, which I would be willing to do.
Yeah. And is that sometimes putting yourself into those situations to please other people as well?
No. It's really just as a communal assistance deciding like, no. I just know in my heart when like it's the right thing to do. And I think that's like the individualistic side coming in, right? It's like saying, am I putting what did you say? Like, am I pleasing? Is that?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. No, it's not about pleasing. It's just about like being there for somebody that needs you. And knowing that, you know, and being able to make that decision of like, where do I want to put my energy? Like, do I want to go to a birthday party or do I want to help this mom that's in need? And maybe there's a win-win. Like, maybe my daughter can go to this birthday party with a friend and I can be there for that mom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that you really are trying to figure out, right, like, what that looks like for you and what that entails for you. Are you married right now? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how is that navigating through kind of your past and culturally parenting your child?
Yeah, so I'm married to like a purebred American and I'm a purebred Indian. And it's so cute. My daughter lately, she's like, I'm from India too. Oh. It's just so cute. She's like, I'm brown like mommy.
Oh.
I just love it. Yeah, so ask me that question again because I just wanted to share that.
You're good. How is that navigating
with
it?
My husband.
Yeah, with your husband. And
yeah, such a good question. He's he started out very individualistic. I found a person that I think what happens is like, okay, so this is how I think of it. If you think about like a computer game, it gets like the computer game of our life, it gets programmed when you're young and you're like chasing after something, right? You're like, when people play a game, they want to do better than the next time or like get a score or like find the treasure or whatever. And so when you become an adult, like you continue to chase after that same thing that you lacked when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was chasing, love. I was chasing acceptance. I was chasing belonging. Because if you can imagine, like at 4, I go to a new country where you learn a new language, a new culture, Nepali. They don't speak Hindi. At 8, I came here, did not know English, learned a new language, a new culture. There's always been like this disconnect of like belonging at those formative, you know, during those formative years.
Right.
And then like with my father experience, which I'll just add on, my American father also sexually abused me and my biological.
Wow.
Me and my American sister. When my sister came over when she was 13, she was spared of that. So I lost my train of thought. Can you help me?
Yeah. So you were talking about belonging.
Yes.
And chasing love.
Yes. And so, you know, so as I'm younger, like I have this computer program and it just keeps playing out on repeat. And so I find this person that is a good man, a decent person, but I don't sense that he loves me. And I'm looking for consistent love. And he's like unable to provide that. And so for 17 years, we've been together for 17 years. I'm chasing that. I'm just playing that game, hoping that one day that consistent love will be there and like it'll be game over. And the truth of the matter was that like it wasn't his job to do that. So last year, how much time do we have?
You're good.
I'm good?
Yep.
Okay. So last year in June, well, it started in May, I decided that I wanted to separate from my husband because I realized that we wanted two different things. I wanted a really deep relationship, one that like you work on. And then he was just happy with status quo. Very, like, not happy, but, like, content. Good enough. And during that separation, he made great strides to like show up and like work on, you know, actually working on the relationship. And I felt a lot of pressure to like stay in the marriage because of the efforts that he was making. And it wasn't enough for me at that time. Like he's like, okay, I'm going to go to therapy, which he was like adamantly, I'm not doing therapy before that moment. And so I really started to feel very trapped. And then there were things that happened at work. There were things that were happening with my daughter. And I was just like at the soul level, just completely vibrating the wrong vibration. And it felt really, really scary in my body. And so I decided to go to residential treatment for depression and anxiety. I had a really bad experience in one place, but luckily I got to shift to another place. And I think that place like saved my life, not in the sense that I was going to take my life, but it saved my life in the sense that that's where I regained my sense of self. And while I was there trying to work things out with my husband, 2 days before I was leaving, I said, I want to separate because it just wasn't quite feeling right. And we like did separate. We like lived separately. He had like huge anxiety attacks from the separation. And I felt a lot of freedom. But some guilt for like being the cause of the anxiety attacks, but being a player, you know, somehow a part of the anxiety attacks. And I have to tell you, he has transformed himself beyond words, and he continues to. And there are moments when I'm like, oh man, it shouldn't be this hard. And then, you know, he takes another leap forward, and I'm just like, okay. You know, maybe it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
So that's him. And and people can change. People do change. And sometimes there's just something in our history that's standing in the way. And if we can just like dissolve that, you're a different person.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what you've said is like people can change, but they also have to be willing to change.
Yes. And, you know, it's not even that people are changing. It's like they're just finding who was already there.
And almost like finding who they needed, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you guys back together? Are you guys, what does that look like?
Yeah, we're back together. What does it look like? It looks like I'm with a person that shows consistent love. But the interesting thing is although he's adjusted in ways that show consistent love, it was in residential treatment that I had to show consistent love to myself to receive it.
Yeah.
What does it look like? It looks like him taking a day off today because my daughter's sick and I already had prior arrangements. It looks like him getting up in the middle of the night last night to give her medicine. It looks like him changing the sheets when she has an accident. It looks like him saying, I'm not feeling connected right now. Can we have a conversation? It looks like him cleaning up the kitchen every night because he knows that it's so important to me to have that fresh space to start in the morning. It looks like him sending a text message to say, I'm so in love with you. It looks like saying, I see how amazing you are. How can I support you? It looks like him going to a men's covenant group at the church, which he would never, ever do. It looks like him wanting to go to church, and instead of me pulling us and taking us in the right direction, he takes us in the right direction. We started to eat healthy, and I totally am not eating healthy because it's a coping mechanism that I have that I haven't dissolved yet. And I told him, I said, you know, it's so nice that you're the strong one, that like you are the one that's eating healthy still, no matter what I'm doing. And I tell him, I'm like, I'm going to join you. Just keep doing what you're doing. Like, be that person that I was for 17 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what does that look like, you know, to showing yourself all of that love too?
Life is so much easier. So I went into residential treatment with this mindset. I'll share a few things. I'm fragile in a hostile world. I'm ugly. I am bad. Those were my core beliefs when I went in. And also the biggest one was I'm unforgivable for what I've done in terms of PTSD things with my daughter. And I was like adamant. I was like, there's no way you can forgive this. No way. And I was lucky enough to stay in residential treatment for 6 weeks instead of the typical four. Four is when you start to just dip your toes into that idea of how worthiness and belonging and lovability is not something that ebbs and flows. It's just there all the time. And I got to stay there for 2 extra weeks, and it sealed the deal. And a lot of people are leaving just having dipped their toes in. It's not enough. They just go back to the way things were, I believe. And so, yeah, what does it feel like? This like sense of self is such an interesting... Can I share a poem to tell you what it feels like?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So here's the thing about never saying that something is the wrong place, because this poem I got from the first residential treatment place that I was at. And I just like hold it in my heart. And so, can I take a minute to find it?
You're good. Okay. You're good. In the lieu of her finding that poem, I just want to reflect on a couple things that I think there's... I'm gonna say a lot of emotion, like that you brought up. Like every human is going through their own thing, and every human has their own story. Like, I'm just so grateful. Like, I didn't think I was gonna cry like this today. But like, this is really what the space of Raw Thoughts is like, we all have our struggles. We all have our past. It's really figuring out for yourself. Like what are you doing? And I think, like, I don't think it helps that I got off of a paramedic shift, you know, this morning. I'm like running on like 2 hours of sleep. So my emotions are very, very high. Like, be gentle with people. You know, I met you at like a speaking encounter. And like, I would never have known that like all of this, right, was like in your vessel and was happening to you or had happened to you. Like, as people, like, be generous.
I love that.
And I think not only like, I don't think just being generous to others, but like, be generous to yourself. Guys, this is what vulnerability looks like on Raw Thoughts. You got the poem pulled up?
No, you put me in. Sorry.
You're good. I'm like, whew. Yeah, I'm a little bit of a hot mess today, but that's life, and we work through it.
Okay, here we go. This is what it felt like to start loving myself, right? That was the thing. Yeah. Okay. So this is a poem by Derek Walcott. It's called Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and with each smile at the other's welcome. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I start again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're good. Okay.
The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. That's what it felt like.
And how do you continue to remind yourself of that?
Like, yeah.
Keep smiling in that mirror that you see.
I remind myself by like being okay with being weird. When I speak to people, I was telling Mackenzie this, I'll close my eyes. Because it's a habit to not be myself. And so I'll close my eyes and I'll just take a few deep breaths and remind myself to be me. And I can feel when I get off track, when I'm not me, there's a constriction. And when I take those two deep breaths or three, it only takes like one or two now. It's taken practice. It only takes one or two now. I center myself and I'm like, yeah, this is who I am. And this is, you know, and it's just okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody else gets to be like you. And that's really special.
If they want to be, I can teach them.
Oh, well, Sengum, I love that we've ended the podcast with you being able to really share that poem. Throughout all of this, like I said, I mean, you've brought up a lot of emotions in me, and just hearing people's stories and what they've gone through and just taking, I know I'm somebody that takes on other people's energies and can feel that and can feel that compassion and can feel that, like, you just want wholeheartedness, you know, not only with yourself, but other people. And I truly can't thank you enough for just one, reaching out and being like, I know I have a story I want to share. And like, this is the story that you want to share, right? And it's you, and it's your variables that you've had in life and your culture. And I just want you to know how much I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for everything that you do.
Yeah. I know you're going through school, social work. How is there, you know, I also know there's a really big, you know, community of Indians here in the Boise area. Like, if somebody was ever to want to reach out to you, how could they?
Okay, so in the Boise area, I don't have any Indian friends.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I kind of, like, don't fit in anywhere. Yeah. I fit in nowhere and everywhere. It's kind of weird. Yeah, I just haven't really connected with the Indian community. I never have, other than my own when I'm in India. Mm-hmm. I'd love to. Yeah. It just hasn't been like an opportunity that has been presented to me. Like, I haven't been invited in and I haven't seeked it out.
Yeah. What if, even if that isn't their culture, like, how can people, if they reach out and they're like, wow, like, is it through Instagram? Do you have, you know, or maybe you don't want them to, you're not ready to.
They can text me or call me.
Perfect.
That's the collectivist in me coming out. And, you know, like, true access.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want my phone number?
I'll put it in the show notes for him. Okay. I'll put them in the show notes for him. Other than that, thank you guys for listening to Sungum's story and allowing us to share vulnerability and be vulnerable on this podcast. It is a welcoming place, and I always want to make people feel safe and feel heard. And, you know, stories like this, just time and time again, week after week, is really helping breaking down those walls of who are you, owning your story, owning who you are, and really diving into, you know, what is your past and where are you going and who are you right now? A lot of this has been heavy on my heart as I'm building a course to teach in Texas. But, you know, own your story and own who you are. And that really comes down to, you know, that self-love, as Sungum has said. So thank you, Sungum, for coming on again. And yeah, that's what I have to say.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Raw Thoughts Podcast guest and listeners, we will hear another story next week. If you have any questions, if you want to reach out to the show, I encourage you to go on to the website. You can always go on to Instagram. All of the information will be in my show notes, and I hope to hear, you know, what you have learned from these guests that come on. I hope you have a wonderful day, and I also hope you remember to take some time and take some love for yourself. You deserve it, and you are worthy. And have a good day. Bye, guys.
Thank you again for listening to another episode of Raw Thoughts Podcast. I'd appreciate it if you could follow, like, subscribe, and share with anybody that you think would be interested in this. You could also head over to my website at rawthoughtspodcast.com and see any other guests that have been on the episodes. You could also go over to Instagram and follow at rawthoughts.podcast. I would really appreciate it, and always send me a message if you're interested in being a guest or any feedback.